Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with today's White House meeting between President Obama and South Korea's President Park Geun-hye, and speak with Sumi Terry, who was the former Deputy National Intelligence Officer for East Asia at the National Intelligence Council and Director of Japan, Korea, and Oceanic Affairs at the National Security Council. We will discuss what Obama's remarks that the days when North Korea could create a crisis then elicit concessions are over means going forward. Then we'll examine the alarming increase in sexual assaults in the military, up 6% to 26,000 last year, according to a report released by the Pentagon today. Jennifer Norris, a former U.S. Air Force sergeant who was forced into early retirement because of PTSD from sexual trauma, joins us. She now volunteers at the Military Rape Crisis Center, and we will discuss the irony that the report came out one day after the Air Force's chief of sexual assault prevention was himself arrested for sexual assault. Then finally, we'll go to South Carolina to get an update on the close congressional race between the disgraced former Governor Mark Sanford and Elizabeth Colbert Bush for a seat that has been held by Republicans for over three decades. Corey Hutchins, an award-winning reporter with South Carolina's largest weekly newspaper, the Columbia Free Times, joins us to discuss today's special election that could be a referendum on the Republican Party standing with women and whether redemption for those who have fallen from grace is alive and well in the Palmetto State. Joining us now is Sumi Terry, the senior research scholar at the Weatherhead East Asian Institute at Columbia University. Previously, she was National Intelligence Fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations and a former Deputy National Intelligence Officer for East Asia at the National Intelligence Council and the Director of Japan, Korea, and Oceanic Affairs at the National Security Council. Welcome to Background Briefing, Sumi Terry.
Thank you.
And when the president said today in the White House East Room after meeting with South Korean President Park Geun-hye, he said that the days when North Korea could create a crisis and elicit concession, those days are over. So what does it mean, though, going forward? I mean, given that the North Koreans created so much tension and drama just recently, they've lost their economic enterprise zone with South Korea. A big Chinese bank just cut off dealings with them. So it would seem to me that if this last crisis was to elicit concessions, they've actually played a hand that's pretty bad. They're in more trouble now than they were before.
That is true, because now they have closed, as you say, the joint Kaesong Industrial Complex, and along with it, about $90 million a year in revenue, which they cash that they badly need. But when President Obama says that those days are over, he meant obviously that this cycle of acting badly, you know, provocatively, and followed by, you know, trying to exact concessions, lure Washington and Seoul back to the negotiating table and lure concessions, this game is up, that everybody's keenly aware of North Korea having playing this. They are master at playing this game, and they've been doing it for a couple of decades. Basically, everybody's now pretty much fed up with this game. So I guess that's what Obama was alluding to.
So, but what does it mean inside North Korea? If this is a case where they've played their hand, overplayed their hand, I guess would be the way to describe it, and got nothing in return and end up much worse off,
they painted themselves into a corner here.
Right.
But the problem is, and this is what I'm concerned about, for now they have calmed down because they're trying to see what's going to come out of this President Obama and President Park Geun-hye summit and what comes out of it and how Washington and Seoul will engage with North Korea. They're trying to see what kind of room they can, you know, if they can maneuver around this. But the problem is, if once there's no real concrete action that comes out of Seoul and Washington, meaning trust politic is all good, the trust politic that President Park Geun-hye is talking about, but if there's no forward momentum and nothing happens in couple months, I'm afraid North Koreans will get frustrated again and the cycle will continue and they will try to further push Washington and Seoul to get some movement out of them.
But the question that arises in my mind, Sumi Terry, is that if this strategy turned out to be a bad strategy, and it probably could have been seen that way before, was this young leader forced to do this by internal concerns about establishing his leadership as opposed to this being, you know, a kind of rational action? In other words, was this done for internal political reasons?
Yes, but it's not so irrational as you might think. It is very rational for North Koreans to act this way. I talked to you before about in this show about how it has always paid off for North Korea to act this way for the last couple of decades. And even now, you might think that they played a bad hand. But in the end, what's so bad about it? Because it's not like Washington and Seoul are going to do anything more. They're at the same spot as they were just a couple of months ago in the aftermath of a missile test and nuclear test. So Seoul and Washington also have very limited cards that we can play. So it's fine that they didn't get Seoul and Washington, North Koreans didn't get us back to the negotiating table to get more concessions. But they're not any worse off, you might argue, than a couple of months ago, because it's not like we can do anything either.
Right, but they're going to lose the hard currency that they get from the enterprise.
That is true. That part, they did play badly, and I applaud President Park Geun-hye for sticking with her gun when she gave the North Koreans a deadline to return to the talks to reopen Kaesong, and North Koreans did not and absolutely ignored her and said, you know, this is a trick and we're not going to return to the talks. Then she followed through with her promise and pulled all the South Koreans out and closed it. So I actually applaud her response and strong reaction. And yes, in that regard, North Koreans did not gain anything from that. In fact, is absolutely going to lose money, as I said, about up to $90 million a year.
But on top of that, the Bank of China is holding transactions with North Korea's foreign trade bank. And prior to this latest round of tension and threats, there were the sanctions that came down from the United Nations in response to the last Korean nuclear test that were designed to prevent North Korea getting monies for export of missile technology and nuclear
right.
technology to close down their banking, etc. So it would seem that that's starting to work. So I'm just wondering whether they're going to be in more of a squeeze after now as opposed to getting concessions.
Yes, you're correct. And they are, as I said, they painted themselves into a corner and there they are. Now the problem is how will North Koreans react now going forward? And again, my concern is, they're just not going to quietly go away and say, oh, well, we played our hand badly. So we're just going to try to now change ourselves and reform and try to, behave normally. I'm afraid that might not be in their calculation. They might say, okay, our provocation was not enough, evidently. So I'm afraid that if they don't see Washington Seoul return to the talks in a couple months, they could act even, take other measures, other provocative steps. And that's my concern.
And again, I'm speaking with Sumi Terry, who was a National Intelligence Fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations and a former Deputy National Intelligence Officer for East Asia at the National Intelligence Council and Director of Japan, Korea, and Oceanic Affairs at the National Security Council. So given that China is their biggest trading partner, there is, of course, a lot of Chinese investment in mining, et cetera, and that's both what little currency they get and what little trade they have is with China. And of course, their energy lifeline is entirely dependent upon China. If this closure of the bank is any indication, what do you think China is going to do going forward? Are they going to put the squeeze on too?
Well, certainly they are doing more than ever before and even now. I'm just a little bit reluctant to say that this shows a true change of heart on China's part, and that they will, you know, they have substantively changed their North Korea policy. I think it's still too early to see that because China's fundamental interest of, you know, keeping North Korea stable and trying to prevent instability, that fundamental priority has not changed. That said, you're absolutely right. China is getting quite frustrated with the North Koreans, and they are certainly taking actions, you know, they have now taken actions that's more than they've ever done before in terms of trying to pressure the North Koreans.
So, Sumitari, it seems that the only trajectory that the country's on is further isolation, further deprivation of their own people, and apparently there's tremendous famine in the countryside and unbelievable poverty. A huge percentage, you know, of the population in gulags, tremendous repression in terms of the, you know, the police and intelligence apparatus and the general control of people's lives by relentless propaganda. But when you see during this crisis, you see the armed forces being visited by the young leader. You see this bizarre and apparently quite sincere adulation that people have, particularly in the main city, which is where people seem to be doing so much better than the rest of the country. So you have this strange situation where they're on a trajectory where they're just going to give more money to the military, they're going to make more nuclear weapons, and their people are going to starve and suffer. And for what?
That you are absolutely right. And the problem is the true suffering of the North Korean people, it's not like that's affecting regime stability. The regime was able to stay in power, that's Kim Il-sung, Kim Jong-il, and now Kim Jong-un, by just really the support of the elites. And as you said, this very pervasive security apparatus along with indoctrination and so on. And they don't care if the people starve in a way. During the mid-1990s, during the massive famine era when millions of North Koreans died, the North Korean regime was able to survive. So they can just, you know, they can just cut off these people. And as long as the elites continue to support, the top leadership, the North Korean state will continue as it is. So unfortunately, this is just the state that it is in, and it's a quite tragic story because only the public is will continue to suffer.
So, if the President Obama and the South Korean President Park Geun-hye have decided not to reward North Korea for their bad behavior, which is the pattern that's been established, and to continue the isolation, it's not likely that North Korea is going to behave any differently. They're just going to go back to their trying to cause trouble and get more attention, like a delinquent child who refuses to be ignored. And so that's not a particularly fruitful path. What about, a game change from this end? I spoke during the crisis with the former U.S. ambassador and former CIA station chief to South Korea, Donald Gregg. And he says that we just should talk to them. And, you know, that's the only thing.
Yes, as you know, by speaking to these folks, including Ambassador Gregg, that there are two camps from North Korea's watchers' perspective. And one camp is represented by people like Ambassador Gregg, who says engagement is really the only option. Dialogue is the only option. Obviously, this kind of, you know, whether you call it strategic patience or none of this is working. This is not an effective policy. On the other side of the spectrum, other folks would argue that we did try engagement. We tried dialogue. We tried dialogue under Bush, which we did under Clinton. We had a 1994 agreed framework. We only to find out in 2001 that North Koreans were secretly pursuing uranium enrichment program. And then even during the Bush era, during the second term, he was not so hardline. He reversed his so-called hardline policy. We tried many six-party talks during the whole six-party talks process. So it's during the Clinton, during the Bush era, we tried engagement. And one thing that all Korea watchers will agree on, whether you're from the right or the left, is that North Koreans are never going going to give up nuclear weapons. They've drawn wrong kind of conclusion from watching Libya and Iraq. And so if that's the case, what good is the dialogue really do? It's only maybe a tactical measure to cap the North Korean nuclear program, but it's not going to lead to denuclearization, which is our ultimate goal, obviously. So that's the conundrum. We don't really have good options, and we tried various measures. It's, you know, we tried completely ignoring them. We tried dialogue. We tried various agreements, and it's just you know, some problems are just not going to have easy solutions, and North Korean is that problem.
Well, they also have the ability to make themselves more of a problem. And last time around, the envelope was pushed pretty hard to the point where a lot of people thought there could be a war breaking out at any moment. And I don't know how real that was. Apparently, one of the things that concerns the military is that North Korea is completely dark. There's no signals intelligence coming out of the country, and you know, the U.S.
And human intelligence is poor as well. So
yeah, no, but I'm saying they have, it's all underground, it's all wire. So if they do anything,
right,
it could happen in a heartbeat, and nobody would know about it. You know
right.
what I mean?
So, you know, I think ultimately maybe both camps are right in that maybe from short term as a tactical measure, you do have to try to engage them in some sort of dialogue, just at least to cap the program or at least to slow down their process. But we really need a long-term strategic view and long-term plan. And I think that involves fundamentally trying to have a different kind of regime in North Korea. Of course, that's easier in theory than in reality, because how do we affect that? Because it has to really come from the North Koreans themselves. We cannot create a regime change. What that means is ultimately we need to help the North Korean defectors. We have to get human rights issue up and forefront. We need to aid the defectors to get information into North Korea, because a true change is only going to come from the North Koreans themselves.
But what about China? China seems to be, as it modernizes and is more and more integrated into the global community, even if there's a split between the diplomatic foreign policy side and the military side, you still get the impression that Chinese leaders are more and more impatient with the status quo. And what could they do to affect change?
Yes, absolutely right. So while we're pursuing this sort of long-term strategic vision and doing what we need to do short-term-wise, the one constant card is pressuring the Chinese. We have to continually talk to the Chinese, and not just to pressure them, but really somehow able to talk to the Chinese and get the Chinese to see that their interests, their own interest is not served by the North Koreans. And I think right now, so South Korean President Park Geun-hye, we have a good chance of that. Madam Park is a fluent Chinese Mandarin speaker. She studied China. She was a former envoy to China from South Korea. So she's in a very good position to talk to the Chinese. In fact, after today's meeting with President Obama, the second visit is to China, her second foreign visit, and not even going to Japan. Japan will be the third visit, which is against the norm. But yes, I think China is definitely, obviously, an important card that we all have to play.
But she also visited North Korea, even after they had killed her father.
Killed her mother, yeah.
And her mother.
She's one of the few South Korean leaders who have met with Kim Jong-il, who is the father of the current leader, obviously.
So, and she apparently said, "Well, you know, let's not look backwards with bitterness, let's look forward with hope." So
that's why she's, even though she's still trying to show that she's tough, this is why she's advocating this so-called trust politic policy, which means incrementally, she understands that North Koreans are not going to change overnight, but let's incrementally take steps forward to build trust with each other, with among North Koreans and South Koreans, to move forward. So she is opening that window, even though, as she said, you know, if North Korea attacks South Korea, they will retaliate, they will respond firmly, but she's still at the same time pursuing this parallel track where she's giving an opening to the North Koreans, saying, you know, my hand is out there, you know, if we could just incrementally try to make progress.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Sumi Terry.
Sure.
Again, I've been speaking with Sumi Terry, who's a senior research scholar at the Weatherhead East Asia Institute at Columbia University. Previously, she was National Intelligence Fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations, the former Deputy National Intelligence Officer for East Asia at the National Intelligence Council, and Director of Japan, Korea, and Oceanic Affairs at the National Security Council. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back talking about the spike in sexual assaults in the military. Going up 6% to 26,000 last year. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Jennifer Norris, who's a former U.S. Air Force tech sergeant who was forced into early retirement because of post-traumatic distress disorder from military sexual trauma. She currently volunteers at the Military Rape Crisis Center, helping both active duty and veteran victims of sexual violence. Welcome to Background Briefing, Jennifer Norris.
Thank you very much.
And President Obama said today that military personnel who engage in sexual assault are betraying the uniform they are wearing, that such behavior is not only unacceptable, but illegal and unpatriotic. Do you think the Commander-in-Chief's words are going to resonate with the rank and file, and particularly the officers?
Well, I think that President Obama's timing is impeccable as far as to us as advocates, it's reached to the point that it's at a crisis level, as evidenced by the increases in numbers. So the fact that he came out and publicly endorsed the fact that this is wrong, this isn't just an issue, it is a crime, it clearly does go against everything that the military stands for.
And of course, the question was in response to the Pentagon report that was released today that estimates that 26,000 people in the military were sexually assaulted in 2012. That's up from 19,000 for the same period the year before. That's a rise of 6%. And of course, those figures themselves may be low, right?
Definitely, we've felt all along that numbers are being unreported or underreported because of the fact that people are too fearful to report due to the retaliation. And that's evidenced also in the report because it shows that in 2011, only 3,192 reported. In 2012, only 3,347 reported. So that clearly goes back to the DOD's implementation plan, which was to improve or increase the reporting, which clearly didn't work.
So how did they come up with 26,000 if the reporting figure was only 3,000 plus?
Well, what they do is they do what's called like a health assessment or a culture survey. And they do it like every 3 years or, you know, it just depends on what that particular survey is that they used at the time. And it's mandatory for personnel to sit down and take these surveys. They're supposed to be anonymous. A lot of us used to feel like they weren't necessarily anonymous. So if people are telling them, you know, 26,000 people are saying this is what's happening, we know that it's higher based on the fact that when we were in the military, we were too scared to say on those surveys whether or not, you know, we had been assaulted because we didn't know if it was confidential. So So that says a lot.
So then this is obviously extremely inexact, but the point that you're saying is that even when you offered a chance to speak up, a lot of people are still afraid. So what will it take to give people that comfort factor? Because the irony is that the one thing that's supposedly been done here is that the military have set up these sexual assault prevention and response programs within the services. And ironically, Lieutenant Colonel Jeffrey Krasinski, who is the head of the Air Force's branch of the Sexual Assault Prevention and Response Program, he himself was just arrested yesterday for sexual assault. So tell me about this program so far, which doesn't look like it's working, this SAPRP program.
To put it politely, it's window dressing. It looks good on paper, just like their policies do, but when it comes to implementation, it's not happening, which is why the need for an organization like Military Rape Crisis Center. They can't turn to someone that's impartial to help them because all the folks in the military are connected in one way or another. So they call an outside organization like MRCC to help them actually get things done because it can't be done within the military. Many reasons for that. One, they don't trust the SAPROs. They know it's just a joke and that anything that comes out of the SAPRO office is like a half measure, if that. So folks know this on the ground that, you know, even though the Department of Defense is saying, oh, yeah, we have this, we have this, we have this, active duty military know better. And they know that it's still not a safe place to go because there's no guarantees for confidentiality. And just like, you know, basically what we want is so when if something happens to someone that they don't have to report it to their boss. That would never happen in the civilian community. There's no reason why it should happen in the military. So we want all the violent crimes taken out of the jurisdiction of the commander or the chain of command so that they will feel safe to go to an impartial, you know, investigative body that will take them seriously, make sure that they're safe, make sure that they're transferred to a new location if they're trying to get away from the geographic location of their attacker. And then if they need to get out, because it's healthier for them to get out, then we help them get out with benefits. Whereas the military, their pattern has been if you get raped, you then turn around and get diagnosed with a borderline personality disorder. Now it's bipolar personality disorder or bipolar disorder. And then they have no benefit. So we're trying to save them from going through extra steps after they get out because it just only makes things tougher on them to get help. So if they're discharged dishonorably or thrown out on a medical, then they're not eligible for VA benefits.
And again, I'm speaking with Jennifer Norris, who's a former U.S. Air Force tech sergeant who was forced into early retirement because of post-traumatic stress disorder from military sexual trauma. She currently volunteers at the Military Rape Crisis Center, helping both active duty and veteran victims of sexual violence. And the SAPRO, the Sexual Assault Prevention and Response Program that you just mentioned, is not working. I mean, obviously, the fact that the head of the Air Force's SAPRO program himself was just arrested for sexual assault would lead one to assume that the culture of those administering this program are not exactly sympathetic to women or victims of sexual violence. Why is that? Is this just the kind of macho culture? I thought that they've been doing sensitivity training and all this stuff. Is it just that the guys don't get it?
No, they get it. What's happening is no one's getting punished for their crimes, and they're either retiring in lieu of a court-martial or the case is never moving forward because the commander's protecting the person, or if it does move forward, you know, the prosecution rate is 80% because the victims are getting re-traumatized over and over. So what you're finding is that even though people might have tried to turn in a predator or a rapist, that nothing happened to them. So in the Air Force, we called it F up, move up, which means when you mess up, you actually get promoted. And that's how things work in the military. If you're in a situation where they don't want you there anymore and they don't necessarily want you out, they'll just promote you to a different location and you can continue on with your business in that new location and nobody knows for the better because there's no paper trails.
And what about the general in Afghanistan that was arrested for sexual assault? Did that make a difference?
Absolutely not. I mean, I think all of these things in totality this past year have helped to bring a point home. But just on themselves, no. We see the same thing over and over that, yes, we take this seriously. Yes, zero tolerance. But then there's never any justice that followed up with it. And then even to take it a step further, on top of not getting justice, these people remain in the military, move up the ranks, and now you're asking those people who once were sexually assaulting at lower levels are now in higher positions doing the same thing, and they're better at it.
Well, there was the case of, in the Air Force in Italy, of Lieutenant Colonel James Wilkerson, who was reinstated after he was found guilty of sexual assault, and an Air Force general overturned the jury's verdict, voiding Wilkerson's sexual assault conviction. And then we've also got the cases at Lackland Air Force Base where 12 instructors were investigated for sexual misconduct towards 31 trainees, you know, with one of the trainers sentenced to 20 years for rape and sexual assault. And then like I mentioned, the Army General Jeffrey Sinclair was charged in 2012 with sexually assaulting a female subordinate, then threatening her career if she went public. So, you know, his case, of course, got some publicity, but so did the case of Wilkerson's, you know, avoiding a jury's verdict. A superior officer doing that is pretty bizarre. And I guess, is that what you're saying, that there's a kind of an old boys club here where when the guys screw up, they get promoted, but when the women get victimized, they lose their benefits and get diagnosed with bipolar and other problems rather than the obvious fact that they've been traumatized by an unfair, by brutal attacks and an unfair and lack of justice.
Yeah, that's exactly what we're saying. The Wilkerson case clearly showed exactly why it is we want to take it out of the chain of command. It absolutely goes against everything that America stands for as far as justice goes. Why should one person have the authority to say, oh, no, I don't believe them and you're not guilty? When in every other case, you would have to go through an appeals process, you would have to do things by the book. What we're saying is this is not okay to have one person have that much authority to throw out a conviction and then reinstate someone so they can go somewhere else and do it somewhere else because, you know, they're friends with a commander. And then the other thing about the commanders having too much authority is that one person, all it takes is one bad command to ruin a good soldier's career. So if that commander decides, oh, I don't believe you, and now I'm going to kick you out because you're a troublemaker, then that one commander has the power to do that. And that's where MRCC comes in, is when they contact us. It's usually after they've reported and they're now being retaliated against. So we help them, you know, do what they got to do to be safe, and then make sure if they're going to get out of the military that they get out with the benefits that they deserve so they can get the help that they need, because they can't get it in the military.
So when you referred earlier Jennifer Norris, that the SAPRO, the Sexual Assault Prevention and Response Program, is a farce, and that people in the military know it is. It's window dressing. What is this other group that you say is effective? MRCC, is that what's it stand for?
Yes, MRCC is the organization that I work for. It's called Military Rape Crisis Center. We're a non-governmental organization that was created in order to help active duty military, because we recognize while we were serving that there was absolutely nothing and nowhere for them to turn. So the executive director created the agency as a result of that while she was still living in her barracks at Coast Guard Boston. This is how amazing this woman is. And since then, it's just grown in leaps and bounds. And at the same time, an advocacy organization called Protect Our Defenders stepped in and then took it to another level with the legislative piece. So MRCC is working on boots on the ground with the soldiers, and then we're feeding Protect Our Defenders all the loopholes and problems and all the different things that most people don't think about. For example, like the Coast Guard does not fall under the Department of Defense. They fall under the Department of Homeland Security, so we have to address them as well in a completely different way. We also have to address each National Guard in each state, because they will not be held to federal laws. They will have to create their own state laws, and people don't know about this stuff, but as we learn it, we're feeding it to Congress and to Protect Our Defenders so that they can incorporate it into the STOP Act.
And in Congress, you've got some champions, don't you, with Senator Gillibrand, Senator Patty Murray, and Kelly Ayotte, the new Republican senator from New Hampshire. What's your sense of what they're doing? And now, of course, the president weighed in today. Whether the rhetoric will be followed up by action, of course, is another matter. But what's your sense of where things stand legislatively?
Well, from what I understand, the STOP Act was stalled by the House of Representatives for this past year, and I actually testified in front of them in January. And I kind of got the same feeling when I was testifying that, you know, it just really wasn't a priority to them. And apparently the senators saw this, the Senate Armed Services Committee saw this hearing and said, this is not okay. You know, you military leaders should have stayed and listened to what the survivors are telling you. So they held the SASC hearing like a couple months later and had four other survivors come in and tell their stories. And it's really, they're really taking the ball and running with it now, because they've got the same stories coming out of different people all over, you know, the country. You know, so it's not, you can't say this isn't happening. The pattern is there. It's been clearly established. Everybody's stories are the same as far as, you know, what happened and then how command handled it and then how their careers ended as a result of it. And you cannot deny those facts. So we need to, we're trying to keep the senators abreast of all these things as they come up, including asking for their help to help us with some issues. Like, for example, can you help us get an expedited transfer for this person off this base so they can get away from this predator? You literally do have to call a congressperson and get the military to act.
And that's what the MRCC does, right? They're able to,
yes,
to people that are within the military that are being assaulted by a predator who's higher up in the ranks and they're cut off at the pass. They can't turn to anybody in the chain of command. They can turn to MRCC, get the information out, and then that's fed to Protect Our Defenders, who and then turn, feed it to the Congress, and then the Congress person then has to go to the top brass in the Pentagon, and it goes back down the chain before anything is done. Is that how it works?
Yes, and what we've been doing all year is trying to educate folks how things work in the military, and as a result, I don't know, it just feels like it's time for that change, because all the things that have come out this past year have clearly showed what we were trying to say. And we're seeing it on boots on the ground with MRCC, too, that not only are they getting retaliated against when they report, but the ones that are getting, like, assaulted and raped by people in their chain of command or officers, They won't say a word. They will not report. They just want to get out. That's how scared they are.
Well, that figure is borne out by the disparity between the numbers of people that have reported rapes and the estimates of 26,000. I mean, that's a pretty stark difference, is it not? You know, from 3,374 reported to 26,000 that actually happened, and even that may be a low figure, right?
We believe that it is a low figure. Based on the fact that we were in the military, so we know how those surveys work. They're mandatory, but we're still distrustful that the information could somehow get back to a leader and it might come back to us. So, yeah, not everybody's going to tell the truth on those surveys. The people that do, it's happening. So, yes, we believe it's much higher.
Well, Jennifer Norris, I thank you for joining us here today and filling us in on this disgraceful situation, which hopefully the Commander-in-Chief, having spoken out about it, will make sure that something is done to address it.
That's what we're hoping for. We feel this is an emergency and it needs to be dealt with immediately.
Well, again, I thank you for joining us. Bye for now.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Jennifer Norris, who's a former U.S. Air Force tech sergeant who was forced into early retirement because of post-traumatic stress disorder from military sexual trauma. She currently volunteers at the Military Rape Crisis Center, helping both active duty and veteran victims of sexual violence. And we're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back and go to South Carolina for an update on the race, the special congressional race between Governor Mark Sanford and Elizabeth Colbert Bush.
For his naive proposals. F is for them farm animals that he brings. You know the one, I'm not a state animal. O is for his out-of-state contributors.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Corey Hutchins, who's a staff writer for the Columbia Free Times, South Carolina's largest weekly newspaper. He was the 2008 winner of the South Carolina Press Association's Award for In-Depth Reporting and was the winner of their Journalist of the Year Award in 2012. He has covered Palmetto State politics since graduating from the University of South Carolina in 2006 and has contributed to Slate, The Nation, and the Texas Observer. He's the author of The Accidental Candidate, about the mystery candidate for the Senate, Alvin Green. Welcome to Background Briefing, Corey Hutchins.
Ian, hey, how are you?
Very well, thanks. And, of course, you know, you have a tremendous amount of press down there from not just national press from all over the United States, but you also have reporters from around the world descending on South Carolina for this bellwether special election, which may not have been quite the nail-biter cliffhanger that people were expecting.
Well, that's true, and it's South Carolina, so we're used to the attention. Right now, I'm standing outside the Renaissance Hotel in Charleston, downtown here, where Elizabeth Colbert Bush is set to basically come into the hall and give her, I imagine, her concession speech pretty soon. I was standing next to the first vice chair of the Democratic Party in the state, a political operative named Tyler Jones, and he's looking at this phone, and his returns are almost all the way in, and Sanford's up 9%. He said to me that he was prepared for a win, and he'd prepared for a close defeat, but not a blowout like this.
And what's the percentage reporting now?
Well, right now, the race has been called by CNN, I believe the Associated Press. with Mark Sanford up 9% was the last reporting that I saw, which I have to say is a big surprise to me. Right. For the past week, I've been telling people when asked that I thought this, if anything, that this race was going to be extremely close. It just turns out, I believe, that this is probably one of the most Republican districts in the country. And I think that if the Democrats were, to win, Elizabeth Colbert Bush would have been that candidate. So, I mean, the Democrats haven't held this seat in 30 years, and I really wonder how long it's going to be.
And that and the figures that I'm seeing now that just coming in are 87% reporting. Colbert is at 45.3% and Sanford at 54.3%. So he's 9 points ahead. Yeah. And that obviously is not going to change. So,
And that's typical in the state for these kind of elections. So it's almost like this wasn't had the anomaly that everybody was imagining. The National Democrats put a lot, millions of out-of-state dollars into this race. 85% of the outside money came to support Elizabeth Colbert Bush, the Center for Public Integrity reported today. The National Republicans pulled out financially of this race after Mark Sanford, after charges of trespassing emerged from Mark Sanford's ex-wife. So this is a topsy-turvy race, and in the end, I mean, it just kind of played out like normal elections do in South Carolina. The Republican wins by almost 10 points.
And what do you think the turnout is? I mean, it's never very high in these off-year elections.
It's a special election. I think both sides got out as many people as they expected. I think that'll be probably one of the big stories to come out after this. You know, did the Democrats focus too much on media advertising and an air war instead of doing the door to door, going out, dragging voters out of their houses and taking them to the polls? In this district, the Republicans were going to vote anyway. The weather was a little rainy earlier today. That usually affects Democrats more than Republicans. The Republicans will go out and stand in the rain, especially here. Like I said, it's a very Republican district and showed itself in this race.
He's only going to be seated for a short period of time, isn't he? I mean, this is a seat.
He's going to have to, he's going to have to run again in 14 months. Here's something interesting. If all the returns come in and Sanford does actually, win this race, which is expected, in 2 days from now, he has to go face a family court judge in a courtroom here in Charleston on that trespassing charge. So that's going to be bizarre. Congressman-elect facing a family court judge on charges of trespassing.
Well, bizarre, but presumably there was enough reporting on this that people would have known about it. So, it doesn't look like they care that much. And so,
no, but it does show the bizarre nature of politics in South Carolina.
Right. Again, I'm speaking with Corey Hutchins, a staff writer for the Columbia Free Times, South Carolina's largest weekly newspaper. He was the 2008 winner of the South Carolina Press Association's Award for In-Depth Reporting and was the winner of their Journalist of the Year Award in 2012. He has covered Palmetto State politics since graduating from the University of South Carolina in 2006 and has contributed to Slate, The Nation, The Texas Observer, and is the author of The Accidental Candidate, about the mystery candidate for the Senate, Alvin Green. Now, if the Alvin Green story didn't cast a light on South Carolina's bizarre politics, I don't know what else did. He was this African American guy that could barely get a sentence out, who suddenly was candidate for Senate, wasn't he?
That's right. He did not. Alvin Green was an unemployed Black Army veteran living with his father in the South Carolina countryside in 2010 when he decided to drop $10,000 of his life savings on a U.S. Senate run in the Democratic primary. He did not campaign, didn't have yard signs, didn't own a cell phone, and yet he won with 100,000 votes. And he beat a guy named Vic Rawl, who was an old judge and a county councilman who'd been in the legislature for several years. And nobody could understand what had happened. There were allegations that the votes were rigged, the election was rigged, it was a major conspiracy. I think what it came down to was just voter apathy. Nobody knew who either of them were, and they voted for the guy with the funny name. I will tell you that the guy he beat was a man named Vic Rawl. And I just spoke to him. He was standing outside of the hotel here at the Elizabeth Colbert Bush rally, victory party. He was smoking a cigarette, and I came up to him and I said, "You want to tell me what do you think's going to happen tonight?" He kind of looked at me and he indicated that he knows firsthand that South Carolina politics, anything can happen, so he didn't want to pontificate.
Well, I guess that pontification has taken place from all of the talking heads on television and all the press that's down there, and after all, here am I covering it too. So the idea that this race would be a referendum on the politics of forgiveness.
Right.
Quick answer on that.
Sure. Well, look, we're South Carolina, okay? This state voted for Newt Gingrich in the GOP presidential primary very recently, while the rest of the national Republicans went for Mitt Romney.
Newt Gingrich. Well, they must. You like philanderers and multiple marriers.
And we'll take them back, yeah.
Home wreckers, right?
Yeah.
And then what about this barometer of the Republican Party's relationship to women? Any indications Sanford had it up, cutouts of Nancy Pelosi, I guess.
Nancy Pelosi, that's right.
The bête noire, right?
Yeah, this is a funny story. Yesterday, NBC reporter approached Mark Sanford on camera and said, I'd like to talk to you about your problems with women. And he said, what problems with women? And Mark Sanford took that reporter with the camera in tow, took that reporter from store to store in downtown Charleston here, trying to find a woman who hated him. And he would go into the store. It was so bizarre. He'd go into the store and say, this girl needs a woman who doesn't like me for her story. Anybody? No? Oh, you'll vote for me? Thanks. It was a bizarre. And then he'd go to the next store. He couldn't find somebody who'd say that, that they didn't like him. He had really put on a charm offensive in this district. He had gone and met as many voters, shook their hands, apologized, humbled himself before them. He talked throughout the campaign of a God of second chances. He talked about seeing a grace in humanity that he believes is a reflection of God's grace. And I guess in this really polite city, it worked.
Well, what do you think the takeaway is for the Democrats if the party put in a lot of money and the Republicans pulled their money out, whereas the Democrats poured money in and they got this bad result here with a loss of 9 points, and of course she's got to run again in 2014. I mean, are they going to run her again?
I really don't know about that. Like I said before, if they were going to beat him with somebody, it should have been her. That didn't happen, I think, just shows you that you could not overcome the demographics in this district.
Right.
A Democrat could not.
But does this signal to the Democrats that their assumption that you can run on the issue of gridlock, which is a fact? I mean, you don't have to be a rocket scientist to see that the government's broken and it's paralyzed and it's gridlocked. But that doesn't seem to have resonated.
No. What happened was she might have made the race about gridlock. And Elizabeth Colbert Bush, the Democrat, positioned herself as an independent businesswoman. She did not want to look like a liberal. However, Mark Sanford spent the past week and a half tying her to Nancy Pelosi, the extreme left wing of the Democratic Party. He debated a cardboard cutout of Nancy Pelosi on a sidewalk here in Charleston because Elizabeth Colbert Bush would not debate him more than once in this race. He hammered inboxes and mail pieces with the specter of Nancy Pelosi in this race, and it really did work. The folks here in this district, these conservative Republicans, don't really care about gridlock. They know who Mark Sanford is, I believe. They know he's a guy who's just going to go up there and say no, no, no. That's what they want. They don't want somebody who they think is going to be an ally of what they perceive as the boogeyman Nancy Pelosi left-wing extremists.
So is that did she therefore make a mistake in not having more debates and having, because she did well in the debate, didn't she? The one debate?
She did have one debate, and I thought she did really well. The room was clearly in her favor, and I think she, you know, it's hard to say who won a debate. I watched the thing. I was really impressed. I actually thought she did better than I expected. I'd have liked to have seen more of those debates, but she was a political novice. Perhaps the campaign thought that they kind of needed to treat her with kid gloves because she'd never run before. She had a lot of people handling her campaign. They did more kind of event-style rallies and events and media availabilities rather than Mark Sanford just going person to person on the street. And, you know, maybe the National Democrats will look at that for other races in the country. But I think that the National Democrats really ought not to look at this race as a barometer. This is a singular event. This is so different here in this district that you really can't take, I don't know, what you've learned here and kind of apply it to another state, I think. The circumstances are just so bizarre and strange here.
Right. Well, yeah, it's terminally Republican. It's that's the message I get from you. This was tilting at windmills to begin with, you know. But still.
And you'll never have these personalities either. I mean, the disgraced former governor with the Appalachian Trail and the Argentine mistress coming back for political redemption. We should note that he actually held this seat before in Congress in the 90s. He was a congressman. He left to become a governor.
Right.
And he got... You know, he left in Oblaki, and then he comes back to become a congressman. It's really strange.
Right. But at least, I guess, just in terms of her race, that it does sound like that she should have debated him more and got more exposure. Maybe people would have, if they would have seen more of her, they would have liked her more. You know, if she, that's...
I think that's the debate that's going to happen inside the Democratic Party after this. What did they do wrong? But I think it's very easy, like I said before, I think it's very easy for them just to shrug it off and say it was such a Republican district that there's nothing we could have done.
Right. So do you think the senator who's been moving to the right and courting with the Tea Party, Lindsey Graham, you think he's safe?
Yeah, sure do. He might get token opposition in the primary, but it's not going to be a big fish. It'll, you know, if it's anybody, it'll just be, kind of typical Tea Party kind of, you know, novice candidate on the statewide level.
Well, Corey Hutchins, I thank you for joining us and filling us in on this race, somewhat of an anticlimax, but nevertheless, interesting.
Keep your eyes on South Carolina. I appreciate it.
I will. Thank you. I'll call you again.
Take care. Thank you.
Bye-bye. Again, I've been speaking with Corey Hutchins, who's staff writer for the Columbia Free Times, South Carolina's largest weekly newspaper. He was the 2008 winner of the South Carolina Press Association's Award for In-Depth Reporting and was the winner of their Journalist of the Year Award in 2012. He's covered Palmetto State politics since graduating from the University of South Carolina in 2006 and has contributed to Slate, The Nation, The Texas Observer, and he's the author of The Accidental Candidate, about the mystery candidate for the Senate, Alvin Green. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon and assistant producer Nick Garino. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. We can also contact me. And I'll be back again tomorrow at 5 p.m. with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.